We're going to explore the impact that the case of Esther, or the person called Esther, has had upon halacha. Last time we looked at a tshuva, we looked at a responsa, which is from the 17th century. And it told over a case where a group of people were traveling along the road. One of them was a married woman who was there together with her husband. They were accosted along the road, and the person who attacked them, or the people that attacked them, were there to rob them, and they were going to kill them as well. When the woman saw that her life and all the lives of all the people were in danger, so she determined that the only way she can save all of their lives was to trying to gain favor among the criminals, among the robbers, pirates, whatever you want to call them. So then she went and she started to be, shall we say, overly friendly with one of them, to the point that she succeeded in seducing one of the robbers, and she did this with her husband's approval. And in the end, she ended up saving her life and the lives of all the people. They just took their money, but they did not kill them. The question that came up, and this was discussed by the Shvut Yaakov, the question that then came up, did she do the right thing or not? Second question that came up, is she able to continue the relationship with her husband as if nothing has happened? And here, when I ask this, I don't ask this on an emotional level. They can go for their own therapy, they can deal with their own issues and so on. And most likely that would have an incredible impact on the relationship. But when I ask, does it have an impact? I'm talking halachically, I'm talking in terms of Jewish law. And what this comes down to is a very simple question. And that is, how do you define rape? Was this woman raped or was she not raped? Because on the one hand, all things being equal, she would not have wanted to have relations with this particular individual. On the other hand, she was the one who initiated it, and she did want to. So what do you mean she wanted to? She preferred to have relations than die. So exactly, then die. So exactly where do you draw the line, and how do you know, or how do you define what is considered to be rape and what is considered to be with somebody's approval? And let's admit something, that I think miscommunication takes place in this topic, and I think the miscommunication takes place today, maybe even more so than it has in other times. And of course, the bottom line, if a woman at any point says no, then that's considered legally in America, that's considered to be rape, if at any point a woman says no. But there's going to be lots of confusion in terms of what exactly is compliance and what exactly is participation and what exactly is considered to be intent. Over here, we have a complicated issue. The way that the Shvut Yaakov dealt with this was in a very direct, simple, traditional way when you focus on Esther. Because again, there's other things that you can look for. You focus on Esther. He did something simple. He says, let's take a look at Esther. Esther, according to Jewish law, was in the exact same situation. What's the situation? The entire Jewish community is threatened. The entire Jewish community could be wiped out. If Esther goes in and seduces Ahasuerus and sleeps with Ahasuerus, gains his favor, and as we learned yesterday, invites him to the party and gets his trust and so on, then she has a chance of saving the entire Jewish people. So does Esther do the right thing or does Esther do the wrong thing? Now, as far as I know, in the Talmud, there never is a discussion whether Esther did the right thing or the wrong thing, or let me rephrase that. According to the Talmud, I never saw anyone say Esther did the wrong thing. Although the Gemara does seem to say that during the whole first part of the relationship, which means that from the time that Esther is taken, Esther is considered to be raped, the problem comes up at the point when she goes in under her own volition. And that's at a particular point in the book of Esther. At that point, her halachic status would change, which would mean that she could not return to her husband, because then she becomes a married woman. And again, according to the Gemara, Esther was indeed married to Mordechai. So at that point, she would become a married woman who willfully had an affair. Now, you can say that, what do you mean she had an affair? She had an affair because she wanted to save her husband. Good, but still, she's married. If you're married, you sleep with somebody other than your husband. That's called having an affair. You can sugarcoat it any way you want it. So that being the case, the way the Shvut Yaakov approached this is he says, this case is the same case as Esther. Just as morally, what Esther did was the right thing, what this woman in the forest did was the right thing. Just as Esther ultimately could not return back to her husband, this woman could not return back to her husband, so therefore he concludes, did the right thing, but can't return to her husband. This question comes up in another place. The other place is in the responsa of somebody known as the Noda B'Yehuda. Noda B'Yehuda, his real name is Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. I think at the very end of last week's class, I told you a little bit about Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. He was the chief rabbi in Prague. He lived approximately 200 years ago, a little bit more. He speaks about this case, and he doesn't like it at all. We'll take off on page 91, source 151, and I'll read. Umikol makom guf din zeh. He goes, regarding the substance of the matter, the ruling that a woman who's married can sleep with somebody other than her husband to save lives is not a correct ruling in terms of Torah. And I absolutely do not like that which I saw something brought down, and he's thinking about the Shvut Yaakov, although it's interesting. He writes, Ulafisha ni la'eta tabikfar. He was away, he wasn't in Prague at the time, he was away, I'm not going to say on vacation, but he was away, I guess in those days as well, they would go, you know, away. He says, Lo uchal lizkor be'ezu tshuva. He goes, I don't remember where I saw this. Uki midome ani shehi tshuvat Beit Yaakov. I think I saw it in the tshuva called the Beit Yaakov. Again, the reality is it was called the Shvut Yaakov, which is pretty close. And then he tells the story. But anashim v'nashim shaholcha b'derech. There were men and women traveling along the road. V'kam aleihim archilistim, and a band of robbers attacked them. Echad b'sadeh im chabura listim shekimoto. A whole bunch of robbers attacked them. Laharogat kulam, to kill them all. Ukama isha achad mehem, and one of the women, she gets up. Eshet yifat toar, a beautiful woman. By the way, this is an embellishment. This is not in the original source that she was beautiful. But I guess the story sounds a little better if she were. In fact, attractive. Sorry, Eshetiva Torah Ma'od, an exceedingly beautiful woman. Okay. Vidchil l'shtadel ma'ish rosh alistim, and she begins to hit on the head of the robbers. Bedvarim ad shepitito b'chalkat l'shona, until she succeeds in seducing him. Shenet avela, that he desires. Who v'niv ala lo b'ya'ar min hatzad, and he has relations with her in the forest off the side of the road. Va'ayadei kein hitzila et bala im kol nefashot. And subsequently, she saved her husband and all the other people there. Upasak b'tshuvahi, and in that particular tshuva, namely the Shvut Yaakov, he says sheshaper avda, that she did the right thing. Umitzvah raba avda, and she did an incredible mitzvah. Sheshal del tol zeh lehatzil nefashot, and she did an incredible thing that she saved these lives. Raksha afal pikein ne'asra al bala, nonetheless, she can't go back to her husband. Vihivi ra'aya me'Esther, and he brought his proof from Esther. Now, what bothers, so far he quotes the case, and he tells you in the beginning, I don't like this. Why doesn't he like it? And he says something very simple, very straightforward, that if I'm not mistaken, somebody said last week in the beginning when we started. In Jewish law, we're taught that there are three things that are considered to be the quote-unquote cardinal sins of Judaism. There are three things that you're not allowed to do even at the pain of death. What are those three things? Again, we should all be familiar with this. If somebody puts a gun to your head and says, murder them, I'll murder you, one is never allowed to commit murder. Right? Go back, Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder, you can't commit murder. If somebody tells you to commit idolatry, avodah zarah, or I'll kill you, you say, I'm sorry, I can't do idolatry, and you have to let yourself be killed. And finally, the third case is if somebody says to commit a case of a sexual sin, or I'll kill you, so once again it comes, a person's not allowed to permit such a sin. So the Noda B'Yehuda puts forth a really good argument. He says, excuse me, if you're not allowed to do these three things, even at the pain of death, then how can you possibly argue that she's allowed to seduce this fellow in order to save their lives? By the way, the Gemara brings up a different case. The Gemara says, are you allowed to heal yourself if you're sick using one of these three things? Like, for example, let's say there is an idolatrous healing method. We actually saw a couple of months ago, we saw a Gemara that talked about somebody doing faith healing in the name of Jesus. And there's a whole argument there. Are you allowed to use some kind of an idolatry to heal somebody? The answer is no, right? There's three things better to give your life. So obviously you can't heal yourself with these three things. In this case over here, this woman initiates to do one of these three sins in order to save her life. So the Nehode Behuda says, how can this possibly be allowed? Now, I want to pause for a second, because for us, there's a very interesting tension over here. We've heard two opinions. Both opinions bring, at face value, a good argument. The Shvut Yaakov brings a great argument. What's his argument? If you say this woman is wrong, you have to say Esther was wrong. He doesn't consider that for a second. Esther must have been right, and if Esther is right, then this woman is right. How can you make a distinction between Esther and this woman? On the other hand, the Nehode Behuda brings a great argument, because it says in the Gemara very clearly, there are three things you have to give up your life for rather than break. All the other mitzvot in Torah, somebody says break Shabbat, you break Shabbat. Somebody eats not kosher, you eat not kosher. And you go through all the other mitzvot in the Torah, you break them, these three things you can't break. So how in the world can this woman, how could somebody argue, how could the Shvut Yaakov argue that they did the right thing? So I'm saying, what's really the issue over here? The issue then becomes, what was the justification of Esther? And therefore, why would that be any different from this particular case? Got it? And he says it very clearly inside. V'ani omer, kevinch omer razal. He goes, once the rabbis, zichrono levorcha, said, b'chol mitra apin, you're allowed to heal yourself with anything, right? Somebody called me up a couple of weeks ago and wanted to know if they're allowed to take medicine which is not kosher. What's the answer?
But medicine isn't kosher.
She checked up. She's actually somebody who has a background in science.
There's another way around it. Well, you're allowed to take medicine on Yom Kippur.
Right. Are you allowed to take medicine which isn't kosher?
Yes.
Yes. Why not?
Because you're allowed to eat non-kosher.
Because it's not food. First of all, to save your life, yeah. Okay, let's go in order. Okay, good. Let's go in order. Let's go in order. To save your life, there's no question whatsoever you can save your life to eat non-kosher food. If you get a doctor's prescription to tell you you're dying and you need pork chops to save your life, now again, I would consider this somewhat unlikely and I would say get a second opinion. But if a doctor says this is what you need to save your life, then you eat pork chops. There's no question about that. But you don't even need a life and death situation to be able to take non-kosher medicine. Why? It's not food. By the way, according to most Jews in America, gelatin isn't kosher. Okay, I'm just saying most kosher organizations in America don't give a hechsher on gelatin. On the other hand, I would assume that all of you at some point have taken gel caps, Advil gel caps, right? How do you let it eat it? What's the answer? It's not food. And by the way, I would say the same thing on Pesach, and there are rabbis who disagree with me, but I would say the same thing on Pesach. Are you allowed to take medicine? Medicine, which is chametz. And what's the answer? Yes. Why? Because it's not food. We'll get there when we get closer to Pesach. We'll talk about more of these things. But let's focus over here now. Are you allowed to take non-kosher food to save your life? Absolutely no question about it. There's three things you can't break to save your life. Right? I can't murder someone to heal myself. I can't do idolatry to heal myself. I can't do a sexual sin to heal myself. I told you, I think, earlier about the Gemara. Yes, I told you, and a month ago, 2 months ago, I told you that there was a Gemara that some guy comes and says, he gets a doctor to say that if he doesn't have sex with this woman, he's going to die. Right? So what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says, let him die. What's the problem? And even then, the Gemara works it down to other cases. What if it would only be that he would see her, he'd have to watch her, look at her naked? The Gemara says, let him die. And the Gemara has no... There's no qualms about that. When it comes to sexual sins, that's not a justification to heal yourself. Over here, he says, you're not allowed to heal yourself for these three things, so what in the world are you talking about? He says, on the other hand, a case of rape is something else. Now, this is interesting. Of course, he says when it comes to rape, and I want to be very careful about what he's saying here. He says rape, a woman doesn't have to give up her life. Why not? It comes down to a very simple point, and that is, what is sex? And I'm not asking for any descriptions right now, anybody to volunteer information. What he's saying is that when a woman is raped, she is being passive, something's being done to her, and what the No Debbie Yehuda is telling us is there's a difference between what you would call sexual intercourse, and the word intercourse indicates two people involved in something, versus rape, where only one person is involved. So he says that even though we know that a woman or a person can't use sex to save their lives, when it comes to rape, rape is allowed. Why? Because to rape, a woman isn't doing anything. She's being passive, and somebody else is doing something to her. And that's what the No Debbie Yehuda says over here. So he's going to have one problem still. What's his problem going to be? His problem's going to be is, how does he justify Esther? How can he explain what Esther did? So this is the solution that he ends up giving. And the truth is, he works a little bit too hard even. Anytime someone's got to work so hard, you have to be a little suspicious, but he works very hard. And he says, and I'm going to skip a little bit over here, and he says as follows. No, what he says is that a person would have to give up their life rather than to commit a sexual sin. On the other hand, he says a woman who's raped has not committed a sexual sin because she was passive, she didn't do anything. So he says the nature of the sexual act, a woman who's raped, that's not a sexual sin because she was passive, she didn't do anything. So the No Debbie Yehuda therefore says, but how this woman in this case, she wasn't passive. This woman in this case initiated it, right? Right.
She's doing it to save the Jews. Why is she?
Correct. At some point, Esther moves from passive to active. Again, you could take this passive argument, the Gemara does, all the way through a particular point in the narrative, and at some point, Esther becomes, you know, the initiator. And that's exactly the problem. Over here, he goes on to say, Avalhecha she'ena anusa alguf habia, if a woman isn't raped in terms of the sex itself, va'adaraba, in this case, he mishtadelet lezeh. She's the one who seduced him, lahatzil nefashot. And therefore, lo mikri karka olam, therefore you can't describe her as being passive in this particular case. Ve'eshetid shaviv tehareg v'altavar, ve'ester shani, and then he says, no, Esther is different. Why was Esther different? So he gives one reason. Shahaita lahatzalat klal Yisrael mehodu v'ad kush. Ve'en lamdin hatzalat yichidim mehatzalat klal Yisrael minar v'ad zaken mehodu v'ad kush. First answer that he gives to make a distinction between Esther in this case, and I want you to tell me if you find this convincing, is he says that this is different. Because who was this woman saving along the side of the road? She was saving herself, she was saving her husband, she was saving a band of people traveling with them. Who was Esther saving? Esther was saving the entire Jewish people, and you can't compare saving a few people with saving lots of people. Do you like that argument?
No. Well, that goes back to what you said in the last class, if you start counting one or two people
ready to go. Exactly. And I'll just continue this a little bit. And how exactly does he know that this is different? What exactly is his proof that 50 people you can save, 500,000 people you can save? Which means if something is not moral, then something isn't moral. Why would the numbers game turn an immoral act into a moral act? That becomes the question. And therefore I'm saying is that's a wonderful distinction. Meaning, what the No Debbie Yehuda do? He said, let me look at the two cases. I don't want to say Esther was wrong, which by the way is another possibility. Esther was wrong. I don't believe he wants to say it. I don't believe any rabbi wants to say it. I don't believe that anyone's going to go in that direction. So he's one on the one hand, he wants to preserve the image of Esther as somebody who did the right thing. On the other hand, how is it different from this woman? So he makes a distinction. Saving a few people, saving a lot of people, there's the distinction. Yeah.
Were Sudanic people completely Jewish, or were they non-Jews?
It sounds like they were all Jewish, but I can't tell you for sure. So then he gives a second reason. He continues and he writes, Visham haya b'horaat Mordechai ubeit dino. And then he adds another element. And he goes, and there what she did was with the permission of Mordechai, and then she adds on, you know, he adds on two words which you don't know from the text of the book of Esther, and Mordechai's Beit Din, Mordechai's court, which means what he just now did is he turned Mordechai into a judge, a religious judge, a big rabbi, a rabbi who could give such orders. And he says, no, there Mordechai told her to do it, and if Mordechai and his court told her to do it, it's the right thing. Now, is that convincing?
No.
Why isn't it convincing? Because again, even Mordechai and his court still have to function based upon the rules of Judaism. So good. So Mordechai said to do it. And why is that right? Meaning, based on what would Mordechai do? And then finally he pulls out a third argument. And again, anytime somebody has to bring me three proofs of something, you realize that it's not, that there's a problem. And again, I'm telling you the problem. The problem is saying that Esther was that Esther did the right thing. Maybe Esther did the wrong thing. But his third argument is interesting. His third argument, he says, "V'ulai beruach hakodesh." Maybe Mordechai or Esther were working with divine understanding, with something which is very close or akin to prophecy, and they have a prophetic understanding that this is what God wants. And that's something I can't argue with, because if they have prophecy, I can't argue with prophecy. Okay, I was not being precise. Yes, he said the third thing, maybe they acted Beruach HaKodesh with divine inspiration. I wasn't being precise. There is a difference between prophecy and divine inspiration. It's not exactly the same thing. And he says that maybe over here there was some kind of divine understanding, this is what's right, even though there isn't a formal prophetic directive that this is what they should do. So again, what does he do? He takes three reasons why Esther cannot serve as a precedent. Again, he doesn't want to say Esther is wrong, even though we saw yesterday that Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin said that when Esther sleeps with this guy, it may have been the right thing to do, but she lost her share in the world to come by doing it. And then he has to work very hard afterwards to show why, nonetheless, Esther was able to retain her share in the world to come. But and that was something called an Aveira Lishma. But nonetheless, the Nod B'Yehuda wants to say that Esther is not a precedent for any other case, and he gave three reasons. One is the numbers game, save everyone versus a couple of people. Two, it may have been based upon a directive from a rabbi versus over here, which is something happens along the way. Three, there may have been some kind of divine inspiration. But what is the Nod B'Yehuda telling you? He's telling you he's very uncomfortable with the precedent of Esther, and he has a good reason for it. What's his reason? He knows what it says in the Talmud. The Talmud says you're not allowed to save your life by breaking Jewish law in this particular manner. So what in the world are we talking about? That having been said, what we're left in this particular case is with two opinions. We're left with the opinion of, okay, let's just review, and then we're going to go on to one more case for today. We're left with the opinion of the Shvut Yaakov, who says, this woman did the right thing, and how does he know it's the right thing? Because it's the same thing as Esther. As Esther did the right thing, then she did the right thing, and therefore Esther becomes a precedent for future cases, but then you judge it exactly like Esther, just like Esther did the right thing, but nonetheless cheated on her husband, even though it was with his permission and with his knowledge. Nonetheless, that would frustrate the continuation of the marriage, and therefore they would need to separate, they would need to get a divorce. That's what the Shvut Yaakov says. On the other hand, the Nod B'Yehuda writes that it's not like the case of Esther. Esther was right what she did, this woman was wrong, but where did he draw a distinction? And therefore he uses these three arguments, which are again, the numbers difference, having a court tell you to do it, and the third, having perhaps some kind of divine inspiration. The Nod B'Yehuda, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. Okay. And by the way, hopefully you realize that at the crux of the issue over here is to what extent, at all, does Esther serve as a precedent? Now, I want to bring another case. This is one of the most remarkable cases I've ever read in responsa literature. It's on page 91, source 152. It's from the responsa, from the Shelot Tshuvot of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and the name of the book is called the Binyan Tzion. just a couple of words biographically about the Binyan Sion, about Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. He lives at the cusp of modernity. If you're taking Dr. Furziger's course, he probably has quoted him at some point. Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger was an old-time Talmudist on the one hand. On the other hand, he was quite sophisticated, quite modern. He is a teacher of Rav Shimshon Frol Hirsch. It's actually Rav Shimshon ben Frol Hirsch. I don't know why they always call him Shimshon Frol. The book is called the Binyan Tzion because the first, if I'm not mistaken, 12 questions in the book are all about what happens when the Jews come back to Israel. Do they build a Beit HaMikdash? Do they build a Mizbeach? What should they do? And there are questions which are mainly posed by Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. These are questions about rebuilding Israel. He has many other questions in the book. This one is absolutely amazing. Now, this is a case that he was approached by the rabbi who was asked the question, which means there's a local family who turned to their local rabbi, asked this question, and then they asked Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, what do you think about this? Okay, this is in Binyan Tzion, Shu't Binyan Tzion, section Siman Kuf Nun Dalet, section 154. Sheila, here's my question. Hineza yamim lo kavir bama selafanai, asher kol hashamea tatzilene shnei aznav. He goes, in these difficult times, a question has come to my attention, and anybody who hears it, it's going to cause their ears to ring. Be'echad ha'kfarim ha'amdim tachat degalai, in one of the cities, one of the towns that are under my auspices, darim yehudim v'darkam, shnei yehudim v'darkam lelech al ha'mischar mahalach eze yamim. There are a number of Jews who live in this town, and their custom is to go and travel on business, to go on business trips. And when they do, v'nishotem l'vadan b'bayit im b'neihim u'v'noteihim u'mishartehim. And the women stay home with the children and with the servants, with the maids, with the house help, and so on. So here, just from the description, it sounds like you're of people who are making a decent living. But on the other hand, the price of making a decent living is being on the road a lot. And on this particular day, the husband, father, head of the household, went off on a business trip. And somebody came and arrived from Poland. Now, Rabbi Ettlinger was a rabbi in Germany. Poland was much more traditional during this time, which means, let's say even in terms of external dress, what you today would call Hasidic dress with a long coat and so on, that's much more, would be called a Polish type of dress. While Jews in Germany and to an extent in Russia were already wearing short jackets instead of long coats and so on. But somebody comes from Poland, ubigadav kruim, and he's wearing tattered clothing, v'yivakesh miisha makom lalun, and he asked the woman of the house if he can have a place to sleep. And this woman who was a very, how would you translate tsnua? You like the word? You like that translation? Tsnua, she was somebody, okay, fine. She was a modest woman, exceedingly modest woman, tsnua bioter. But even though she had great fear of God, she was not the brightest of people. Rachma alav, she had compassion on this guy. V'natna lo makom lalun, and she gave him a bed to sleep in. V'gam le'achol u'lishtot, and she also gave him food and drink. So here we have a case.
Why does that make her not right?
We'll see. We'll see. We'll see.
We'll see.
A couple more lines.
Would she not know this Polish man?
Okay, here's the case. Here you have a man goes away on a business trip. He leaves his wife at home, running the house. A stranger, who she doesn't know, comes to the door wearing old-time Jewish religious clothing. Clothing is torn, knocks on the door, I need a place to sleep. So she said, now right there, again, I can ask you a question. Right there, your husband's away, do you take guests in, do you take... gentlemen guests into the home, or do you not take? You can decide for yourselves. I won't. Right? I won't bother telling you what I think. Or should I? No, you guys, I said, you can decide for, you determine for yourselves. But by the way, one thing which is interesting, which you don't get yet, which will come out as the story goes on, who used to go around traveling like this from place to place? There were times, and there's a whole literature, what's that? There's a whole literature about famous rabbis who were treated too nicely in their hometowns, and therefore to work on their souls, to work on their own midot, they would dress up as poor people and travel from place to place and get abused a little bit because that's what they felt they needed. I don't think this is a problem today. I don't think rabbis are treated nicely today. They don't have to travel any place. They can stay home and they can be abused at home. They don't need to go anywhere. So she lets him in. She gives him a bed. She gives him food and drink. V'gam la'ochel l'shtot. Amnam ha'oreach ha'hu lo achal etzla shum davar min hachai. This guest does not eat anything, which anything alive, which means it doesn't eat anything which is growing. Doesn't eat any meat, any fish. Gam lo shata mashke rak mayim. And the only thing that he drinks, that she can see him drinking, is water. Ukehina asa maase prishut, and he continues to act in a way. I need to translate prishut. Lefrosh means to separate. Look, let me tell you what's going on, and then I'll read the words some more. He's trying to make believe that he's some kind of incredible tzaddik. Doesn't eat, doesn't drink. He acts in terms of prishut, which means he separates from this world. V'siyef atzmo b'sigufim kashim kol hayom. And he basically abuses himself all day. How so? Yoshav b'chedro misugar. He sits in the room that was given to him with the door closed. V'sefer b'yado, having a holy book in his hand. Gam midei laila b'laila ad chatzot. And every night until midnight, he's sitting there as the guest of the home. He's just sitting in his room with a book open, learning. Till midnight, and at midnight he would get up and start crying, say what's called the tefillah called Tikkun Chatzot, pray for the destruction of the temple. And when he did lie down, he never lied down on the bed that was given to him, or a bench. He lied on the floor, and he had rocks under his head for a pillow. And every morning he gets up and he goes to the local river, Shel Nahar, from the river. And again, to use a river as a mikveh could be a really nice thing to do, but if I'll continue right now. Pamim be'et hakor kenahag be'bayit hisham yom aleph parshat truma ad shabbat kodesh parshat tzaveh. He did this from Sunday of parshat truma, which by the way is this week. This week is parshat truma. He did this from Sunday parshat truma all the way to Shabbat parshat tzaveh, which means it's the middle of the winter in Germany. It's freezing. You go into a river, you know, to use as a mikveh. You take your life in your hands. Basically, this man is trying to give the impression that he's some kind of a hidden tzaddik, some kind of big, you know, righteous person. He doesn't sleep in a bed. He doesn't eat any food. He only drinks water. He sits and he learns all the time and prays all the time. Goes to, you know, to be tovel in the freezing mikveh, freezing river. Amnam bilel Shabbat, Friday night. Acher gemar su'edatan, after the end of the meal, hatikim u'mishartei bayit amdu kulam me'al ha'shulchan v'alchu lishon l'cheder acheret. All of the people get up Friday night and leave the table, which means the children leave and the servants in the house leave. Va'ish ha'ramai, so now is the first indication that there's a problem here. How do you translate ramai? The deceitful man. Odeni Yosheva Shulchan, this deceitful man is still sitting at the table, Ima Isha Levado, alone with this woman, Vinichnas Ita Bidvarim, and he starts to speak to her and saying all kinds of mystical, Kabbalistic things, Ad Shesha'ala Oto, till she finally asks him, Mi Ata, who are you? Umi Ayin Tavo, and where have you come from? Va'ana Telech, and where are you going? Which means he has succeeded in totally intriguing her. And now she's trying to figure out, who are you? You mean you must be somebody special. You must be some big rabbi, some big tzaddik. You must be somebody. V'anala, and then he uses one of the great pickup lines, and he says, Shlucha d'rachmana ana. He says, I am on a mission from God. I'm a shaliach of God. Ushmi, and what is my name? Eliyahu Hanavi. I am none other than Elijah the prophet. I am Eliyahu Hanavi. Ve'et achai anochi mivakesh. And I'm searching for all the Jews. L'kabetzo tamei arba kanvotz aretz. To find the Jews who are dispersed all over the world. Ve'ein megalin hadavar ela litznuin. And I'm not allowed to tell who I really am, only to very modest people and to only special people. So basically he tells her, I'm Eliyahu Hanavi, I'm really a very holy man, and I'm not allowed to tell this to anybody except to people who are very special, and therefore obviously he's telling them they're very special. Va'isha l'rov sichlota, and this woman with all of her intelligence, himina lo, she believed him. Hilchalishon al mitata b'cheder hasamuch. She went then to lie down on her bed in the adjacent room. The ha'ochar hanal, now it's even better than our mind now, ochar is this leech, is sitting, odenu yoshev al mikomo, he remains sitting on his place, v'ayin b'sefer, ad chatzot halayla, and he remains sitting by the table, looking to a book till midnight. V'la'achar chatzot, and after midnight, amad v'halach la'at al etzpa'ot raglav, he goes on his tippy toes very, very softly. El hamita asher isha shachva shama. He goes to the bed where the woman is lying down. V'hi'irota mishanta. And he wakes her up from her slumber, from her sleep. V'daber ileha. And he tells her the following. Hine halachti mikatzeha aretz v'ad katzeha aretz. I've traveled from one end of the earth to the other. V'lo matzati tzadeket kimotech. And I have not found a woman as righteous as you. Asher hi ru'uya latzeit mimena Mashiach, a woman who's worthy to be the mother of the Messiah, the mother of Mashiach. Achamniyahi, the problem is, mitzad ba'aleich, your husband, she'enu hagun l'kach, your husband's not quite on the right level to be the father of Mashiach. L'kach, l'zot nishlachti min hashamayim, I was therefore sent from heaven, l'shakev otach, to have relations with you, uke'etcha, and as I live, I swear to you, till diben, you will have a son, v'hu ye Mashiach ben David, he will be the Messiah, the son of David, v'yigalet Yisrael, and he will be the Redeemer of Israel, v'zelach ha'ot, and he says, I will give you a sign, I'll prove that I'm Mashiach, I'll prove that I'm Eliyahu, v'zelach ha'ot ki Eliyahu anochi, I'll prove to you that I'm Eliyahu, Hine biyom gimel habaleinu tova, on this coming Tuesday, la'achar hi pardi mi'itach, after I leave, after I take my leave from you, im tiftach at petach ateva asher omed po, b'cheder mishkavech, if you open up the drawer, which is in this room, in the bedroom, timtashem otzer matmon rav arbama oduduk katin, you'll find a treasure of 400 shelzahav, 400 gold coins, on condition you don't open up the drawer before Tuesday. Thus spoke, how do you translate no'ef? The lotin'af, the adulterer. Okay, now he's gone from the Aramai to Nocher to no'ef. So, if we'll pause for a second, this guy did come up with, again, incredible pickup line. I'm Eliyahu Hanavi, and you're righteous enough to be the mother of Mashiach, and I was sent from heaven to have sex with you. Right? That's the line that he uses on her. Ad shepita, till he seduced v'tibei ota, and defiled her. Pa'amayim, twice, bilel Shabbat, umatzoy Shabbat, he slept with her both on Friday night and again on Saturday night. Uveyom harishon ter melot hashachar, Sunday morning before daybreak, barach hanoef misham v'lo nadeh mikomo. On Sunday morning before daybreak, the guy hit the road, ran away, was never heard from again. Ve'isha tzolot hanal, and this woman, silly woman, chashal chtov l'ba'ala, she yeshuv maher l'veito. She decided she should write to her husband. Where was her husband during all this? He was away on a business trip. But if she's about to have a treasure of 400 gold coins, he doesn't need to work. So she sends a message to him saying, "Dear, come home. Good news has happened." Obviously, she believes it. She believed everything else he said till now, right? She sends a message, "Come on quick, God has given us a treasure." And the husband listened, and the husband came, arrived there on Tuesday. And the woman opened up the drawer. You'll never guess what happened when she opened up the drawer. Oh, you did get, you've heard this before. No, I'm kidding. She opened up the drawer, v'lo matza me'uma, and there was nothing in it, mehamatmon, from the treasure, asher amar hano'ef, which the adulterer had said, uvruota ki sheker b'piv, when she now realized that the man had in fact lied to her, sa'aka, she screamed, ubachta, and she started to cry, b'mar nafsha, bitter tears from the essence of her being, v'sipra l'ba'ala et kol hato'iva she'asa harasha hazeh, she told her husband all the terrible things that this man had done to her, v'dibra alev alibo, and she spoke to his heart, and she said, "Halo lo b'merid uvama'al asiti zot." She said, "I didn't do this to rebel from you or to cheat on you. Sahadi birimomim, you know, let God be my witness. Let be my witness from heaven. Kavanati haya l'shem shamayim. My intention over here was for the sake of heaven. V'halo hanoef haya ish ma'us." She goes, "Not only that, this guy was really ugly. Umichu'ar ma'od, uma yasiteni liznot imo. And what would have made me want to sleep with a guy like this? Amnam alabal lo shaket bazeh. The husband was not really at all satisfied with this. Rakba ilai visiperilit called the dvarim, and he told me over what happened. Visha'al mimeni kedat mala asot im ishto. And he asked me, what should he do? Vishalachti achrisha. I sent for the woman. Vachakarti bechakirot shonot. The rabbi writes, I cross-examined her, v'hisi prali gam kakola drim hanal, and she told me over the whole story, v'tziveti lefrosh zemizeh, and I asked them to separate from one another, ad shetziya devar lefnei kvodo, till I ask you, Rabbi Ettlinger, what to do about this, ze tochen ha-shela. That's the question that the rabbi sent me. Ladies, how would you analyze this case?
She committed adultery.
Is this adultery? It's not adultery. Why not?
Because, I mean, in her state of mind, she believed that it was God's will to do this. Yeah, but either way, you're not supposed to die. Like, to the Esther piece, like, if Esther is committing adultery by saving a whole group of people, and then why this woman thinks that the Mashiach is coming from it, what's the difference?
Okay.
So
one second. So is consent from the husband really a significant factor in this?
Oh, yes, I think so. Because then it's not adultery.
No, there's still so many other things with it.
So let's stay on this, because I think this is a very important point. If a husband says to a wife, "Listen, it's fine, you can sleep with other people," does that make any difference in terms of Jewish law?
No.
Right? I mean, that shouldn't make a difference.
But if in the Esther case, the consent,
how do the consent? No. When you're going back to the Noda Behuda's argument, the Noda Behuda, when he brought up the consent of Mordechai, he didn't bring up Mordechai as the husband. He brought up Mordechai as the court. He said Mordechai ubeit dino. He said Mordechai was the rabbi. Mordechai was a religious leader, and therefore, when Mordechai said it, so then what? Meaning, if I tell you something is kosher and it turns out it's not kosher, and you went and asked a rabbi what you should do, and you ate something, and then afterwards you found out the rabbi was wrong. What, you didn't do anything wrong in that case. The rabbi did something wrong in that case. Just, you can then stand in front of heaven and say, "God, I did what I had to do. I asked my rabbi. My rabbi said it's fine. What do you want from me?" So over there, what the Noda Behuda, again, he was searching for a justification of Esther, and there he argued that Mordechai consented, but not Mordechai playing the role of husband, but Mordechai playing the role of rabbi or religious leader. So over here, do you still think is the husband a factor in all this? If the husband would have been home and the husband would have said, "Wow, you know, you, A, you'll be the mother of Mashiach. B, we're going to get 400 gold coins. Does that make a difference? But by the way, let's leave Mashiach out of this. If a husband says to his wife, listen, sleep with this guy, we'll get 400 gold coins. Would that... It's like prostituting, right? I mean, would that make any difference whatsoever? I mean, that would now become moral because the husband said it's okay? Absolutely not. I mean, in fact, if anything, it's even more detestable, correct?
Well, it's still adultery because...
Adultery is what you do with an idol, yeah.
It's still adultery because she did it willingly.
Ah, so this comes down to the question, would you define this as willful sex, or would you look at it as something else?
It's more rape than it's not rape. It's not trickery.
Was that important factor that it happened twice? Why?
Once, if she really was the mother of Mashiach, then one time would have been enough. Why does she?
No, well, let's bring the whole thing is that she doesn't understand. She doesn't believe it. So if you're already believing one time, then I mean,
but then the.
Like,
why?
The fact that they have sex a second time doesn't mean that
the
light bulb goes off to her.
No, that's not when it goes off. She still sends a letter to her husband. Come home. God hooked us up. God is taking care of us. We got all this money coming in now. I mean, that's what she does. She sends a message to him even after the guy runs away. And the guy got out of there real quick before daybreak, which means as you're listening to the story, you know that there's a big problem over here, which is why he said that she's not... You know that bride. She's a very righteous woman, and he took advantage of her righteousness. He took advantage of her good heart. He took advantage of, you know, her. What were her basic feelings? This poor guy, it's the middle of the winter, needs a place to stay. How can I not offer him a place to stay and give him some food? That's basically what her approach is over here. So over here, you have a really decent person, and on the other hand, you have a guy who's a disgusting, you know, individual. Apparently, he's not that good looking, so he needs to resort to incredible pickup lines, including "I'm Eliyahu HaNavi, and God sent me to have sex with you." I mean, again, I'm saying it doesn't get much better. It doesn't get much better than that. But on the other hand, I mean, I do want to stress something. What would be the answer if this guy was Eliyahu HaNavi?
Then it's okay.
Then it's okay? Let's say he was Eliyahu HaNavi.
If it wasn't, then it would be another exception that we're all looking at.
No, I'm saying if it was Eliyahu HaNavi, what would be the answer?
Why would God do that?
Right, which means, no, it's even sharper than that. In order to have Mashiach arrive, God must have a better plan than to ask someone to commit adultery to bring about Mashiach. But by the way, let me put it this way. You know, theoretically, and I touched this a little bit last time, theoretically, you know, the world's in a balance, good deeds and bad deeds. And let's say there's more bad deeds and more bad deeds and more bad deeds. And Eliyahu comes and tells you, listen, we need one more really bad deed, and that just tips the scales over, and Mashiach's going to come because God is basically giving up on you guys and needs to send Mashiach. So do that one more bad deed. Would you be allowed to do it? Absolutely not. Since when can you justify sinning even to bring about Mashiach? Which means even if this really was Eliyahu HaNavi, and even if every word he said was true, which of course wasn't, even if every word that he said was true, the answer would be, sorry, tell God to find a single woman for this guy to sleep with, or, you know, arrange something else. This is not the way that Mashiach is supposed to come and save the world. But I'm saying, look, this woman did not come to our class. She didn't study with us, so therefore she didn't know exactly how she was supposed to respond in this case. But let's go back to the... You're calling her stupid now.
Yeah.
So let's go back now to the question, because we've heard two voices over here telling us that, no, this does sound like rape. Go ahead.
What is it? It's like more gray area.
Okay. How gray?
But it's more towards the rape aspect than it is towards the rape
and sensual. And why would you define this as rape? What were
the... He gave her all the... He, like, fed her all these lies, and which made her, like, pass out, basically.
Okay. What Rav Yaakov Ettlinger says in his conclusion here, and I'll tell you right now, he himself is not 100% comfortable with what he's saying, but he ends up, and I'm not reading through the entire answer, but it goes on and on and on. He says, V'hayotzei הזה שאם נאמר כן, אז בזינתה ברצון לשם שמיים, לא נקרא שמעלה בבעלה, אכן אין כדאי לחלוק על מעריק. He goes on to say over here, this one, and he quotes the Shvut Yaakov, let's just see where I want to read this from. He says, on the one hand, this woman did this l'shem shamayim. She thought that what she was doing was the same thing as Esther. She, again, and I heard somebody say this before as well. What's the difference between what Esther did to save the entire Jewish community versus to bring about Mashiach, which will save the entire world? Now, again, you could draw a distinction and say, no, there the Jews were threatened, they would be killed unless something would happen. On the other hand, I think that we could make an argument that bringing about the Messianic age would effectively save the people at least as much as Esther saved the people in Shushan, maybe even more so. So, again, she's wrong. She was lied to. But what he goes on to say is, I just want to read the words. He says, if a woman, he brings the case of the people in the forest, and he says, in that case, and he basically agrees with the Noda Yehuda, he says, in that case, the woman wasn't raped. Why wasn't she raped? Because she seduced him, she initiated, she wanted it to happen. Again, in terms of her greater worldview, you could say all things equal, she didn't want it to happen. Right? She didn't start off the day saying, wow, I hope I meet a robber along the way over here. This would be a great fantasy. That's not what happens. What does happen is she is willful in the sexual act. Over here he says, אבל אם הבילה בעצמה היא באונס מותרת, אין שם. והשתה בנידון השאלה שאמר לה הנואף ימח שמו. And now when this cursed adulterer says, שאול היה נביא, ולזאת נשלח מן השמיים, and therefore was sent from heaven, לשכב עמה, והימינה בו, הובלת כל כך, עד שקרא לבעלה, she believed him so much that she was doing the will of God, till she finally called her husband and said, come home, because God is taking care of us. לקבל הישרות כאילו כבר הוא בידה, אם כן לפי הובלתה הייתה מצווה מן השמיים על בילה עצמה. As far as she was concerned, she was told by God in heaven, through his agent, through a malach, through Eliyahu Navi, that this is what God wants of her. So what do you, again, she's wrong, she's dumb. She should have been sharper. She should have been more cynical. But she wasn't. And he says, ve'ein lecha ones gadol mizeh. And he says, this is rape. Which means, this is what's really, I think, important about the tshuva. He says, this is rape. V'lo nitkavna ba'abila lem'ol ba'ala. She did not intend to cheat on her husband. Ki im kamosha amra. And she said, let heaven be her witness. Ki kavanata l'shem shamayim. She thought she was doing a mitzvah by doing this. He says at the end, ein l'smoch al horati. He says, I don't want you to rely on my ruling in this. Im lo yaskimu al ze od shnai mi balei hora. Unless two other prominent rabbis agree with me, v'az etzdaref imam l'hatir isha l'bala. He goes, if two other prominent rabbis agree, I will then sign and say that this woman can go back to her husband. Which basically, well, look, I don't know how the story ended. I never saw this quoted by any other place, but what Yaakov Ettlinger is saying, in this particular case, where a woman is doing it, first of all, he calls this rape, which I think does stretch the definition of rape a bit, because again, you called it a gray area, but he's saying, no, it envelops that gray area. Because you can rape somebody, and this is also close to what you were saying before, you can rape somebody putting a gun to their head, and you can rape somebody, he's saying, by playing with their mind. And that's what this guy did. He played with her mind till he got to the point that she thought that she was doing a mitzvah, to the point that she thought that God had sent her money, to the point that she believed everything that he had said. So he says, somebody played with her mind so much, she was raped psychologically. Right. She was raped psychologically, and therefore the physical action that took place, which was willing, was based upon that psychological rape. Again, I find this tshuva fascinating because it does, again, that's why I'm saying he's on the cusp of modernity. What he does do is he takes into account the psychological profile of the woman, and he takes into account where her mind is at. Because again, I can just say, did she willfully have sex with someone other than her husband? Yes, that's it. Game over. Nothing more to talk about. But that's not what he does. Is he analyzes this in terms of also intention and where she's coming from and what she thinks. And again, if you think about it like this, the Shvut Yaakov, in the case of the people in the forest, what was his conclusion? Conclusion is, she did the right thing, but she can't go back to her husband. Right? And his reason is, Esther. No, the Behuda took the same case, and what did he say? He said, she did the wrong thing and can't go back to her husband. What's his proof? The Talmud says you can heal yourself or save yourself based upon one of these three things. This case, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger says, she did the wrong thing, but she thought she was doing the right thing. And because she thought she was doing the right thing, it ended up that she thought she was no different from Esther, as Esther was saving the world, and therefore Esther was justified. She thought she was doing the right thing, and that's enough. Meaning, again, if you were to ask someone, is it the wrong thing? It's the wrong thing to do. But because she thought she was doing the right thing, what her perspective was does make a difference, and therefore he's willing to call this rape, and therefore he's willing to say that even though she willfully had sex with this guy, this willfully was tainted because of the psychological duress that she was under, and therefore Rav Yaakov Ettlinger says that she could go back to her husband because this woman was raped. Again, he does qualify this and say that he doesn't want to be relied on exclusively, and he would prefer if two other prominent rabbis agree, but nonetheless, that's what his decision is. Again, for me, just to conclude for this week, for me, what's interesting over here is the use of Esther as the precedent, which means this question, under what circumstances could a woman use sex to save people, the precedent for this question becomes Esther. Again, I'm not saying that Esther is the only precedent, but Esther becomes the precedent, and we've seen different rabbis in slightly different situations grappling with the precedent of Esther, asking themselves, now how far can we take this? When can we apply it? What we haven't really found was any halachic authority saying Esther was wrong that no one wants to say. Everyone wants to say that Esther was right, what Esther did was justified, and the only question becomes why it was right. If you follow the opinion of the Shvut Yaakov, he doesn't even bring up the question. He just takes that as a given. You follow the opinion of the Noda Behuda, he grapples with it a little bit more. We look over here in Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he also believes that Esther was right, but therefore is even willing to stretch it a little more, and therefore other people who believe that what they're doing is right can also be justified. So I think that's like as far as you can possibly stretch this. But as I said, I find this case absolutely fascinating. And anybody who's going to then go on and then discuss psychological impressions and what people think and state of minds, this becomes an incredible case in order to a case study in order to consider what the implications of a psychological profile. Okay, we will continue next week.